In the age of information, ignorance is a choice. You have at your fingertips a limitless supply of knowledge. So if you want to base your perception of history, not on your own research, but on the controlled mass media and the garbage that comes out of Hollywood, then go ahead. Hollywood, which is controlled by the very same people who have vested financial and political interests in promoting their own version of history.
Are you critical of the Hollywood that makes violence?
I think that I'm angry with some of the Jews. I'm very goddamn angry at some of the Jews. Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews.
Hollywood's depiction of World War II and the Holocaust is as accurate as their depiction of the Wild West.
Was the year in which World War I broke out. Within 2 years, Germany had won that war. The German submarines, which were a surprise to the world, had swept all the convoys from the Atlantic Ocean, and Great Britain stood there without ammunition for her soldiers, stood there with 1 week's food supply, and after that starvation. At that time, the French army had mutinied. They lost 600,000 of the flower of the French youth. The Russian army was defecting. They didn't like the Tsar. And the Italian army had collapsed. Not a shot had been fired on the German soil. Not an enemy soldier had crossed the border into Germany. And yet, here was Germany offering England peace terms. Well, England, in the summer of 1916, was considering that. Seriously, they had no choice. While that was going on, the Zionists in Germany went to the British War Cabinet. Look here, you can win this war if the United States will come in as your ally. The price you must pay up is Palestine after you have won the war and defeated Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey. They made that promise in October of 1916. Now, that is something that the people in the United States have never been told. They never knew why we went into World War I. After we got into the war, the Zionists went to Great Britain, and they said, let's have something in writing that shows that you are going to keep your bargain and give up Palestine after you win the war. And that was called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration was merely Great Britain's promise to pay the Zionists what they had agreed upon as a consideration for getting the United States into the war. That is where all the trouble started.
Above all, we must remove the Jews. They run our banks. They lost us the war. They alone are responsible for the economic disaster we're in.
When you ask what have the Germans done to the Jews, you must always ask what have done the Jews to the Germans. Since 1850, when the Jews became got all the political rights in Germany, the German Reich, they have done three things which are really dramatic. Number one, they were a small minority of 2% of the population. At the time when Hitler came to power, 500,000 within 60 million German people. 500,000 among 60 million. They were a small minority. This small minority managed to control about 50% of the media, to give about 70% of all judges, to have a tremendous influence in movie and in theater and in literature. They were overrepresented. This is one thing. They were absolutely overrepresented, as today in England, in France, and in the United States. Second, Jews were at the origin of a lot of catastrophic financial bank crashes in Germany between 1870 and 1920. In that time, they made a lot of crashes which have, this is all documented, it's not Nazi propaganda or anti-Semitic or Arab propaganda, it's a lot of books have been published, even by Jewish Germans, about this problem. They have, millions of German fathers have lost their incomes, their fortune, their savings, because of these Jewish gangsters, bank gangsters and speculation people. Then the third point, which was psychologically the most dangerous of all, they have introduced into German art and culture and theater and movie decadence, immorality. The first homosexual theaters, plays, were made in Berlin in the 1920s. The first adultery theater plays were made in the 1880s and 1890s, 100 years ago, by Jewish authors. Adultery, then sexual perversions of all sorts, sadism, masochism, lot of homosexuality, all these things, and then decadent art, you know, an art which is absolutely ridiculous, so-called modern art. It was all pushed by Jewish intellectuals, and this created among the German people a big revolt. And they wrote books ridiculing Christianity, ridiculing Jesus. And there were furious reactions in Germany. And this is why Adolf Hitler came to power. And you see, then Hitler in 2 years, from 33 to 35, he brought 6 million unemployed Germans back into their jobs. He created 6 million jobs. It's incredible.
Let me summarize a speech given by the Jewish millionaire businessman and political advisor, Mr. Benjamin Friedman, in Washington in 1961. Mr. Friedman knew exactly what he was talking about, because he was an insider at the highest levels within international Jewish organizations and a personal friend of at least 4 United States presidents. He was also a member of the 117 strong Zionist delegation at the signing of the Versailles Peace Treaty in Paris in 1919, where Germany was forced into bankruptcy and social chaos. We name this video "Judea Declares War on Germany," because the historical facts show it was international Zionism that wanted to destroy Germany and Hitler, and not the other way around.
The problem with history, truth being the first casualty of war, is that the victors write it, resulting in a completely one-sided account of what transpired, painting the victors as heroic and just in a patriotic light, and the losers as evil, sadistic monsters. This can be likened to a fight between two school children that just got broken up. Neither account is accurate or conclusive, each child usually bending the story in favor of themselves. This example is not only true of children, but of men also. The Holocaust is the most tabooed subject in modern history. In the West, one can openly question the existence of God, ridicule Jesus, Muhammad, and Buddha, among other religious figures. One can even critique and slander prime ministers and presidents. Yet although the latter points may be frowned upon by some, they are nevertheless condoned and protected by free speech. Yet one can be jailed for simply inquiring about the Holocaust in at least 17 different countries. If you are to ask for proof of 6 million Jews being gassed, in say Germany for instance, you will be arrested and quickly find yourself amongst a prison population of murderers, paedophiles, and rapists. This fact alone proves we are not being told the entire truth about this period of history. The mere fact that you can be jailed should in any reasonable person's mind shed an aura of doubt on the overall veracity of the subject.
They're having gassed 6 million Jews, but I don't think 6 million Jews were gassed. Now, be careful, I beg of you, this is against the law in Germany. If there was a German, somebody that's a German state, you could have me thrown into prison before I leave Germany. I hope that's not your intention.
A quote from Jewish professor Dr. Norman Finkelstein, taken from his book, The Holocaust Industry. Much of the literature on Hitler's final solution is worthless as scholarship. The field of Holocaust studies is replete with nonsense, if not sheer fraud. Given the nonsense that is turned out daily by the Holocaust industry, the wonder is that there are so few skeptics. When the war was over in 1945, it was alleged that Jews were exterminated in some 22 different death camps, all containing homicidal gas chambers. Here are the facts.
Put the issue in some perspective, especially for the audience. When the war was over in 1945, it was claimed that there were 22 camps that had gas chambers in them. 22. By the 1950s, 16 of those camps had been officially revised by the Americans, the Israelis, the British, the Soviets, and now it was only claimed that 6 camps in Poland had gas chambers. In other words, what happened was the camps that were in Germany and Austria were able to be investigated by Americans, freely investigated by historians, but the camps in Poland were not made available to Western researchers.
To further corroborate David Cole, here is a document issued by the Allied Military Police HQ. The document reads, "The Allied Committee of Inquiry has to date proven that no poison gas was ever used to kill prisoners in the following concentration camps: Bergen-Belsen, Buchenwald, Dachau, Flossenbürg, Grossrosen, Mauthausen, and satellite camps Natzweiler, Neuengamme, Niederhagen, Ravensbrück, Sachsenhausen, Stutthof, and Theresienstadt. In all cases where gassings were alleged, it could be proven that torture had been used to extract confessions, and witnesses have lied. Any former inmate who during their debriefing continues to allege that poison gas was used to murder people, in particular Jews, are to be reported to this office. And if they insist on lying further, they are to be charged with perjury." Signed, Major Miller, Commanding Officer of the Allied Military Police Vienna, witnessed by Lieutenant Lecount.
Thank you.
We've all heard that some 6 million Jews were exterminated by the Germans, mostly in gas chambers. But this number has a history that long precedes World War II and Hitler's rise to power.
The Holocaust is always blamed on the German people, but a Holocaust on 6 million Jews was already being bemoaned in Jewish literature in 1919, at least 14 years before Adolf Hitler came to power.
For further information on the true origins of the 6 million figure, one can read the book The First Holocaust, subtitled Jewish Fundraising Campaigns with Holocaust Claims During and After World War I.
In Krakau ging vor einem polnischen Gerichtshof der Prozess gegen die Hauptverantwortlichen für das Konzentrationslager Auschwitz zu Ende. Insgesamt kamen nahezu 300.000 Menschen verschiedenster Nationen im Konzentrationslager Auschwitz.
I know from years of my own research and the research of others that proofs of the Holocaust are few. Literally, all there is are the eyewitness testimonies and post-war confessions. There's no picture, plan, or wartime document dealing with homicidal gas chambers or a plan to exterminate the Jews. And we can't use the excuse that the Nazis destroyed all the evidence, because after we had broken the German code, we were able to intercept their secret transmissions, including those that came from Auschwitz. The key to understanding the Holocaust story is understanding the true nature of the things passed off as proofs. Everything that is used as evidence of the Holocaust also can be said to have a perfectly normal explanation. For example, these exhibits are said to be the material proofs of exterminations. There's the piles of human hair. But what does that prove? It's acknowledged that each inmate had his or her head shaved because of the lice problem. That's not denied, so why wouldn't there be piles of human hair? What about the piles of shoes and clothing? Is that a proof? It's a fact that the prisoners were issued a uniform upon arrival, including shoes. So why wouldn't there be piles of inmates' shoes and clothing? It doesn't prove anybody was killed. What about the canisters of gas? No one denies that Zyklon B was used to disinfect clothes and also buildings. Zyklon B was one of the premier pest control agents in Europe at that time. It was present in most of the concentration camps, including those that are not said to have had homicidal gas chambers in them. The typhus epidemic that spread throughout Europe during the war, and also spread through the camps, called for stringent lice control procedures. So what other proofs are offered? Well, there's the usual pictures of sick inmates, which proves the groundbreaking thesis that people got sick in the camp. Once again, I'll add that nobody denies the typhus epidemic, which resulted in many deaths. Then there's the artwork and the pictures of children. But at this point, it's looking pretty bad for somebody looking for objective proofs of the gas chamber. And some of the proofs they present actually work against the concept. For example, they have one of several aerial photographs taken of Auschwitz by the Allies during the war. They don't mention, however, that when blown up, these photos don't show people being gassed or bodies being burned, even though they were taken during the time killings were said to be going on almost non-stop. Once inside, we can see why revisionists have had such a field day with this building. Obvious marks on the walls and floors, where apparently walls had been knocked down. Equally obvious holes in the floor where bathroom facilities had been. We maintain that, unlike the large hollow chamber we now see, this room had once been five rooms, including a bathroom. Yet the building does have what appears to be evidence of criminal usage. Four holes in the ceiling, which lead to the roof, where four little chimneys stand. It is said that through these four holes, Zyklon B crystals were dropped. And indeed, there seems to be no other explanation for them. Do these holes prove homicidal gassings? Revisionists have claimed in the past that these holes were added after the camp's liberation, and that the inside walls were knocked down and the bathroom facilities removed to make the room look like a big gas chamber. Let's start again talking about this building here. This
crematorium gas chamber.
But this is a reconstruction.
It is in original state.
Original
state.
And the ceiling?
It is in original part. Original.
It is original.
Original in through this chimney was through Zyklon B.
Are those the original holes in the ceiling?
No.
They've been rebuilt?
Yes.
Okay. After the war?
After the war, yes.
This is the BBC. They're going to be marketing their film to television corporations around the world. I'm going to be standing there in their so-called gas chamber at Auschwitz I, and I'm going to be pointing out, oh, no holes in the roof. So that rather makes a mockery of your eyewitnesses who said that they saw the SS men clambering up on the top and dropping the pellets through the holes in the roof. Oh, look at that door over there. It's got a glass pane in it. A pane of glass in a gas chamber, in a door. And there's a 2-inch gap under the wooden door. It's a drafty gas chamber, this one. Right? I'd be asking questions like that, and they know they can't stand that. And so this is the reason that I'm banned from the Auschwitz site.
The doors, and he says, the door has to be absolutely airtight. Otherwise, again, the gas escapes and kills the people outside. The doors of the gas chamber that are shown to tourists at Auschwitz is absolutely not airtight. Absolutely not.
The roof holes have, once again, been crudely smashed through the concrete. Fixtures that probably belong to toilets have been removed, but proving this alleged gas chamber once had a toilet. And then there is the door, of flimsy wooden construction with a window, and the locking device on the inside, a door that could easily be kicked out. The tinge of blue you may see here comes from the flashed photos and not from any staining from Cyclone B on the walls, because there isn't any. Back up on the roof, Dr. Tobin points out the crematorium chimney, a chimney that is not found on any Allied aerial photos at the time. But we believe it was added later by the Russians. But whoever added it did not bother even attaching it to the building. Across the roof, Dr. Tobin points out how ludicrous it is to imagine an SS man standing up on this roof in a strong wind, trying to hold the poison-soaked roof cover in one hand, and with the other hand, trying to pour highly poisonous crystals down into these holes without getting powder all over himself, and have it blown all over the rest of the camp as well, especially with his own barracks just over the road. And we can only wonder in amazement at what the camp commandant did on those days when the wind was blowing in his direction, because his own house is on the same street and less than 60 meters from this chamber. Although it is still presented to the public as a gas chamber, who is naive enough to believe that German engineers, who were already developing rockets capable of space travel, designed this?
What, aside from the samples, convinced you that these facilities could not have been used then or now as execution facilities?
You must have gasketed doors, no windows, means of getting the gas in, means of getting the gas out. If those persons operating the facilities didn't gas themselves to death at the same time that the executees died, they certainly would have been blown to bits when the gas exploded from a switch, the heat of a light bulb, or the gas approaching and getting into the crematory furnace. We're talking about brick and mortar buildings without heat, with non-explosion proof lighting, without gasketed doors, in some cases without doors at all, and with crematories that opened very close or adjacent to the facility. I mean, it's just ludicrous to consider that these facilities could have been used as gas chambers. There was no such a thing as an eyewitness. I have never seen a report that was written by anyone who had a valid description of what could have happened at a gassing. So the long and the short of it is, there are no eyewitnesses because there were no gassings.
Prove it. Explain to me, for example, how it's possible to gas millions of people in gas chambers and yet leave no significant residue of the poison gas used, hydrogen cyanide, in the fabric of that gas chamber. And our opponents say, hey, 50 years later you don't expect to find residues of a gas in a gas chamber. The answer is you do. And any chemist worth his salt, excuse the pun, any chemist worth his salt will confirm it. And a gas chamber which has been exposed to hydrogen cyanide gas over the years, over 40 or 50 years, you're still going to find residues of that totally permanent compound, ferric ferrocyanide, which is otherwise known as Prussian blue. In fact, it's so permanent a stuff that it's a dye stuff. It's the blue dye stuff known as Prussian blue. So you've got this substance which should be in the walls of the gas chambers even now 50 years later, and yet it's not there. Although allegedly millions of people have been gassed in these buildings using hydrogen cyanide. And we can prove it should be there because just a few hundred yards away in the Auschwitz complex is a little gas chamber, which looks like a gas chamber. This one's got gas-tight doors and a peephole and rails for for little railings for carrying in, the racks full of clothing, because it was used for fumigating clothing, the prisoners' clothing. And the walls of that little gas chamber in Auschwitz are so soaked with ferric ferrocyanide that on the outside of the gas chamber walls you can see the blue stain seeping through. And colleagues of mine back in February 1988 took samples from that gas chamber, illegally, they hammered and chiseled away samples of the brickwork from that, and samples from the brickwork of the other gas chambers where allegedly millions of people were gassed, and they took them illegally back to the United States, and these 40 samples from the little gas chamber here, the fumigation one, and the big lethal one, allegedly, samples were taken back to the United States and tested by qualified American forensic laboratories for the concentration of cyanide still found in them. And in this little one, which was used for fumigating clothing, they found no fewer than 141 milligrams of cyanide residue per 1 kilogram of brickwork. Colossal concentration. You can actually see the blue stain in the wall still. And yet in the buildings where they had allegedly murdered millions of people with cyanide gas, there's not the slightest significant trace of cyanide residue.
German industrial chemist Germar Rudolph, in his work The Rudolph Report, published in 1993, largely augments what the Leuchter Report pioneered. Germar, like the rest of the Holocaust revisionists, was jailed for proving that no homicidal gas chambers ever existed, ruining his career and destroying his family. The German judge's remarks, "Truth is no defense." It is illegal to refute the Holocaust in most of Europe. Anyone who tries gets thrown in jail, harassed, beaten by Jewish Zionist thugs, or murdered. There is no freedom of speech left in the West. The International Red Cross, a human rights organization, openly visited all of the supposed death camps throughout the duration of the war. The official IRC records refute the widely accepted 6 million death toll. Seated and guarded since the end of World War II at Aralsen, Germany, the official IRC records reveal the actual concentration camp total death toll was 271,301 inmates. Now this includes all people who were interned in the camps, not just the Jews.
The next section is called A Holocaust Under the Nose of the Red Cross. Jewish leaders have directed anger toward the International Red Cross for not revealing the Holocaust or doing anything to stop it. They point out that international teams of Red Cross inspectors visited and inspected every major German concentration camp, including Auschwitz, right up to the end of the war. On the one hand, the Holocausters expect us to believe that the Germans were murdering tens of thousands of people a day in a super-secret plan that they dared not mention, even in their top-secret orders, and on the other, they expect us to believe that the Nazis would let the International Red Cross, with people from many different countries, inspect those same camps and interview the prisoners freely during the same period that they were supposedly killing many thousands each day in those same camps. Here's excerpts from a telling USA Today article, and I quote, "Many Jewish leaders and Holocaust experts have long contended that the Red Cross failed spectacularly during World War II, mostly by not raising an alarm about Nazi atrocities, and compounded the failure by refusing to acknowledge it. In fact, in a November 22, 1944 letter to the U.S. State Department officials about the visit, the Red Cross said, quote, "We had not been able to discover any trace of installations for exterminating civilian prisoners." In this case, the documents show the Red Cross failed at every possible turn. Not only had the Red Cross officials neglected to grasp the situation, but then they passed along bad information to the Allies. a tendency to disbelieve horror stories. Several Red Cross documents suggest that the organization was reluctant, at least initially, to put much faith in tales and rumors of Nazi brutality. Like the general public, Red Cross officials didn't comprehend the true extent of the Nazis' crimes. There is no doubt that the Red Cross let itself be used by the Nazis, says Radu Ayanid, director of the Holocaust Survivors Registry at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Brzezem. There is no doubt they were fooled. Unquote. Obviously, if the grievously high death toll was from lack of medicine, shortage of insecticide for killing of disease-spreading lice, and food, because of the destruction and disruption of the war, the Nazis would have had no fear of international Red Cross inspectors and volunteers in the camps helping out with the situation any more than the British would have feared them helping in the ruins of East London after an air raid. Do the promoters of the Holocaust story believe that the members of the International Red Cross were part of an anti-Semitic Nazi Holocaust conspiracy? Or did their members from many different countries, in spite of visiting the camps during the war repeatedly and delivering to prisoners 973,000 packages and parcels, as their own records show, did they simply see no evidence at all of mass gassings or burnings or extermination facilities, or for that matter, any effort on the part of the Nazis to purposefully exterminate the Jewish people?
Cyclone B dropped into the death chamber from a small opening. It took from 3 to 15 minutes. We knew when the people were dead because their screaming stopped. After the bodies were removed, our special commandos took off the rings and extracted the gold from the teeth of the corpses. Children of tender years were invariably exterminated, since by reason of their youth, they were unable to work. Is that all true and correct, witness?
Yes.
It was the British who obtained, by torture, the confession of Rudolf Hess, commandant of Auschwitz, before turning him over to the Soviets and Poles. This has been confirmed in a book published in 1983 titled Legions of Death, which contains the recollections of British Sergeant Bernard Clark, who brags about having tortured Hirst to get a confession out of him and of threatening his family. It was here that Hirst was hanged.
Judge Edward Van Roden was a member of the Simpson Army Commission that investigated the methods used at the Dachau concentration camp. In the January 9, 1949, Washington Daily News, and in the January 23, 1949, London Sunday Pictorial, he told of some examples of the use of torture. And I quote, "The investigators," he said, "would put a black hood over the accused head and then punch him in the face with brass knuckles, kick him, and beat him with rubber hoses. All but two of the Germans in the 139 cases we investigated had been kicked in the testicles beyond repair." Unquote. Now I'm going to divert from the book and repeat that again. All but two of the Germans in the 139 cases we investigated had been kicked in the testicles beyond repair. Much of the Holocaust proof offered today by historians is the confessions extracted at the war crimes trials. I thought, can we trust the confessions of those whose testicles were damaged during interrogation? I was also shocked when I learned that Russian KGB officials, who themselves had committed extensive crimes against humanity, against Christians, sat as judges. One of my friends at the Citizens Council told me that an American judge who was president of one of the tribunals exposed the injustices of the Nuremberg trials, and I found out that Iowa Supreme Court Justice Charles F. Winterstrom had resigned his appointment in disgust at the proceedings. He charged that the prosecution prevented the defense from obtaining evidence and preparing their cases, that the trials were not trying to create a new legal principle, but were motivated solely by hatred of Germans.
The vast majority of the photographs that are circulated to give weight to the Holocaust narrative were taken at Bergen-Belsen and Buchenwald. In neither camp is it any longer alleged that people were gassed. At neither camp were the Germans caught in the act, as the pictures are to imply. Bergen-Belsen, for instance, was voluntarily offered to the British because the Germans could no longer support it or contain the ravaging typhus epidemic.
You were on the scene in Belsen as a young man.
Yes, I went with a group of medical students and we arrived in Belsen on May the 2nd, 1945, and I first went to the camp on May the 3rd. Himmler ordered the camp to be seeded on April the 11th in order to stop typhus, which was an epidemic spreading throughout Europe. The British came in, the tank division came in on April the 15th at 3 o'clock. And they did their best to segregate the typhus and the dying from the others.
How many people were in the camp at the time when the British took over the camp?
I think there were about 57 or 60,000. The British bombed everything, and the Americans that moved on the roads. So that getting food there was extremely difficult. The water supplies became contaminated with sewage, and the administration in the camp more or less broke down. The distribution of food in the individual huts was left to the inmates. And the inmates, we found out, we were fooled at first, this was after May, after I got there. The inmates, if one particular group was in control, they would take what they wanted and then leave whatever food was over to the rest of the huts. So that meant perhaps 10 powerful people would gobble everything and 350 would have whatever was left. Oh, they were all, I say all nationalities, mainly Polish and Russian. Most of them were Jewish.
Were there men and women?
Yes, there were men and women.
And, when,
and children.
And were they
segregated?
Segregated camps, and that was still segregated when you got there?
Or? Yes.
Yeah. Even, let's say, if the German camp administration had made maximum effort and had been given everything at hand, could they have prevented this?
Yeah. There was no cure for typhus at that time. The British put DDT, which is an insecticide, over everything and everybody. And in that way, I think the typhus was contained. But it was a great danger. People don't realize it was typhus. It was, I suppose 50-60% of people died who got it.
Why are these bodies naked? I mean, some of them are so emaciated, why don't they have their clothing on?
Well, they did, and they, when they were pushed outside of the huts, they had clothing on, but clothing was so scarce, everything was scarce, that the inmates would immediately rush out and take all the clothing off, because it was a pity to waste it. That's why they were naked.
Did you see, when you got there 2 weeks after the British Army took over, any evidence of gas chambers, the way propaganda has said that the Germans had in these camps? Or was there any claim made to that effect?
No. I don't think it was ever thought that there was a gas chamber in Belsenburg. People were dying at 500 a day, by the way, a rate of 500 a day.
Even under British administration?
Under British administration, yes. And what was happening was that the English soldiers were giving people their food, and people half starved and had very thin stomachs, and the stomach would burst and they'd die. The inmates said that they, conditions there, this was what the inmates said, that conditions weren't too bad until the end of 44, and then this mass immigration. But by the time they put in another 50,000, of course.
Now, I read in German language books, and I'm not sure if it's accurate or not, but that Britain broke a promise to those soldiers to let them go to their own lines, and that there was rather brutal treatment on the part of some of the British soldiers against those Germans.
I don't know where you read it, because I've never been able to find it, but that's what we understood, that most of them had been finished off. That really upset me, because I thought that, you know, we were fighting a war for ideals and honour, and this was the most dishonourable thing, to agree to give and safe conduct back to the Alliance. And then those that stayed, because a lot slipped away, to beat them up.
Yeah. Were you there during the time when the bulldozers were actually putting these bodies in the graves? In these long trenches that you see?
The bodies were being thrown in. The truck went round every day and picked up the bodies outside the hut.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were taken to where the bulldozer had dug the grave, and they were thrown into the grave.
You are a man born in England. You published this article, I believe, for an English publication in the London Times. Picked up on what you had published here?
That's right. This was published in November 1968. I was asked to write it. I was solicited. I had no intention of so doing.
Nobody ever interviewed you from any German magazines or papers?
Oh, no.
To this day?
Not to this day.
Did anybody ever officially from Germany come and contact you for a kind of a historical documentation, like they have got these archives in Koblenz and places like that?
No.
Never.
Never.
Here are some pictures of a concentration camp during the American Civil War. This particular camp is called Andersonville. Here are some pictures of people who were skinny, malnourished, emaciated, and deceased. These pictures almost parallel entirely with that of the Jewish prisoners liberated during World War II. Is this then proof that people were gassed during the American Civil War? Or is there a more logical explanation? It's also worth noting that it took the British over a month to get the typhus epidemic under control, during which some 13,000 prisoners perished. The big mass grave full of emaciated corpses that you've seen was dug by Germans at gunpoint. That bulldozer pushing corpses into the pit is a British bulldozer. The typhus epidemic was extremely severe and explains why the German camps contained Zyklon B. These sites were used to impress upon the German people and naive Allied troops the wickedness of the National Socialist regime. Bodies were left for weeks after the camp liberations, purposefully stacked and unburied, as tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were bussed in for the tour. A table was set with artifacts like shrunken heads, human skin lampshades, collections of tattoos, etc. Things that are now proven frauds and have been quietly dropped from Holocaust historiography. Importantly, none of these camps had gas chambers, even though at first they tried to claim that they did. Not only do the autopsy reports conducted by Dr. Larson and others, as well as the documents procured by the Red Cross, explain the dead and skeletal bodies found during camp liberations, but also it is necessary to lay the context of the final months of the war. Germany had more than half of her railroad capacity destroyed several months before D-Day. This is one of the major reasons why Germany could not get armaments to the Eastern Front. The rail lines, roads, bridges, transports, and supply lines were deliberately targeted by the Allied Air Force. The work camps were mostly supplied by rail. Thus, the food supplies collapsed. At this point in the war, Germany could not feed the majority of her citizens or soldiers, let alone her prisoners in the concentration camps. Is this not a far more reasonable explanation as to the skeletal and emaciated bodies found post-war? Are these people simply a result of the Allied bombing campaign towards Germany? Or would you rather believe these bodies are the result of 6 million Jews being killed in homicidal gas chambers?
Crawford, director of the Center for Research and Social Change at Emory University, where we have started a most unusual and important research project that we call Witness to the Holocaust. We have three eyewitnesses who were in the military who saw Buchenwald, the camp that is an infamous camp for all sorts of reasons that we will bring out later. But to my left is John Glustrom, who was the first of the three to actually get into Buchenwald in April of 1945.
They took us first into the administration building, and in the administration building, the shocking thing I saw was the lamps made out of human tattooed skin. And some of the lamps were lit and in use at the time we came.
And I also saw the lampshades, though not directly. I looked through a window and saw them that way.
And that was not the only material, not the only things they had done with the human skin. And
Pulled out from his pocket, he said, "Look what I got." He said, "I found this in there," and it was a wallet made out of a woman's breast with the nipples on the inside, so that when you folded it and unfolded it, it looked like there were two buttons there. I too had been told that there was a camp in our area. I got permission to get a truck, and I took a squad of my men. We went to the camp. In the front of the camp was this sign, which I could interpret, which said, "Work makes you free." There was another sign that I couldn't interpret, that an officer was there who told me that this other sign stated, "Those who enter here leave all hope behind." We walked through the gate, and as I walked through the gate, one of these literally walking skeletons, and you could tell that he was nothing but a skeleton, not only from his face, but from the way the clothes hung on him. And as he approached me, he said in Hebrew, "Shalom Aleichem." And I said, "Aleichem Shalom, how did you know that I was Jewish?" And he looked at me and he said, he said, "I know."
And we saw the gas chambers, and the inmates told us that the spigots in the roof were supposed to be showers, and they got people undressed inside the room. They told them they were going to give them a shower and a delousing, and then they locked the doors. There were huge metal doors. They locked them tightly, and then they turned on the gas. They eliminated the gas after they were dead, and they went through the bodies and pulled their gold teeth and took whatever jewelry they had missed, examined them in all their openings of the body to find this jewelry, and then there was a chute that dumped down into the furnace room.
We have documented for all to see the truth from these three eyewitnesses. You cannot forget Buchenwald. You must not forget the Holocaust. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for telling this story.
His campaign tried to clean up a sizable Memorial Day gaffe about his family's role in liberating a notorious Nazi concentration camp.
I had a uncle who was one of the, who was part of the first American troops to go into Auschwitz and liberate the concentration camps. And the story in our family was is that when he came home, he just went up into the attic, and he didn't leave the house for 6 months.
Obama's point dealt with the need for more mental health services for today's veterans, but it was built on false history, both about his family and World War II. First, Obama didn't have an uncle who served in the U.S. Army. Second, Russian forces liberated the Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland in January of 1945. There is no record of U.S. forces entering Auschwitz because it remained in Russian hands as part of Russian-occupied Poland after the war. Barack Obama's dubious claim is inconsistent with world history and demands an explanation, the Republican National Committee said in a statement. Obama's frequent exaggerations and outright distortions raise questions about his judgment and his readiness to lead as commander-in-chief.
Herman Rosenblatt received international attention for his story about being a hungry little boy in a Nazi concentration camp who was thrown apples every day by a little girl on the other side of the fence. Years later, according to the story, Rosenblatt met that same girl on a blind date in New York City, and he proposed on the spot.
I used to come by every day, bring the apple, have in my jacket, and a piece of bread, and used to say, I'll see you tomorrow.
The story landed Herman and Roma Rosenblatt on Oprah twice and in newspapers all over the world. They also got a book and movie deal. But the story wasn't true.
Such a big lie to so many people for so long.
It wasn't a lie to me.
How can you say it wasn't a lie? It wasn't true, and you know it's not true.
Yes, it's not true. But in my imagination, it was true.
So you were not motivated in any way by money?
No.
Herman and Roma Rosenblatt told their false story publicly for more than a decade, but it all fell apart about 6 weeks ago after Holocaust scholars proved that it was physically impossible for prisoners to approach the fence at the concentration camp where Herman was kept, and that Roma's family was actually more than 200 miles away at the time.
Why did your wife agree to go along with this? Did she ever express any reservations?
Because she loves me.
Was it difficult for your wife to have to go out very publicly and tell a story that she knew wasn't true?
It was. It was. But
Rosenblatt is remarkably unrepentant about his years of lying.
I pronounce my love for you forever.
When you look at that, does it make you uncomfortable at all?
No.
Let me ask you just quickly about
it. I didn't hear you say you agreed to it. Do we agree to that?
Our interview was frequently interrupted by this man, Harris Solomon, who says he is planning to produce a fictionalized movie account of Rosenblatt's story, despite complaints from critics.
If you had to do it over again, would you tell the same story?
Yeah.
And the movie version is supposed to start shooting this summer as well in Eastern Europe, Diane. And they say they're going to carry on despite the criticism.
So who do you believe? Those who receive media coverage, sympathy, and reparations, despite the blatant absurdity, lies, and falsifications they spew forth? Or do you believe the academics whom are silenced, ridiculed, bankrupted, beaten, and locked away?
We also had an orchestra where some of the musicians stood together, and one musician was so good that he had the instruments playing, and he wrote the notes, so later on we had a band who played over the weekend. And that was, of course, helping us, you know, we also did plays and stuff.
Were there any cultural activities happening in Auschwitz?
Yes. I told you we had a piano put into a, not just a piano, a grand piano was brought into block one. Once that was built, that new block, the downstairs room was assigned for theater.
And they said they're going to build a movie in the camp. And the prisoners said, "Only you must be crazy. They're going to make a movie for us in the camp." And really it happened. They made a movie in the camp. Yeah, and we went in barracks after barracks. We could go to see a movie sometimes in the evening. They brought movies in to see in the evening. And
what kind of movies would they show?
Well, German movies. But once I came to the main camp, we were allowed twice a month to write home. Once a postcard and once a letter.
They gave you the materials?
Yeah, they gave us the letter, the materials, and we could.
You had money?
Yeah, we still got money. We got through the Jewish community from Vienna who sent us everybody some money.
And in the camp you could have currency?
Yeah, we could have money because there was in camp also what they call a cantina. And not many times, but once in a while they sold a few cigarettes or they sold something, whatever they had. So if you had money you could buy in the cantina there. Redeemable in that cantina if they had something. So that was their way of distributing money then to everybody. Everybody got this money then.
Soccer teams were organized very well. And one of these top enlisted SS men decided he wants to play for the Polish team. So we say, okay, you can play for us. And then the commandant, SS commandant, he was like a captain. He decided to want to play for the German team. So he went in the field. But that's happened. But it was 1944. So.
It is what you're saying then, that the closer the end of the war came, pressure was let up rather than becoming more cruel or...
Freddy Hirsch called me to the children's barracks he was heading then, and he asked me if I could paint something on the wall for the children. And I said, well, if you can get the materials, he said, I'll get the materials. I said, okay. And then a very handsome young blonde man from the men's camp came over one day, and Freddy Hirsch called me to come and meet him. And he asked me what I need, so I said, well, if I can get any wall paints, so any tempera paints, I would like those, if you can get me some. And he said, yes, anything you want. So I made a painting of Dopey standing on another dwarf's head with a cloak around him, so he looked like a tall guy, so he would be as tall as Snow White. I now understand that there was another painter who continued something painting on the walls after I've left.
What did it do not only for you but for the children on an emotional level?
Well, it did several things, not just emotional, but the children then wrote a play which was a satire of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The play was very successful because the little girl who was playing Snow White had an incredible voice, a gorgeous soprano, just like the one that you hear.
Revisionists concede that there were concentration camps, labor camps, and ghettos established by the Third Reich into which Jews were placed. And they concede that, yes, anti-Jewish laws were enacted by the Third Reich, and that Jews faced a certain level of persecution. especially after the 1933 Jewish declaration of war and international boycotts upon Germany. What we question is the dogmatic and unfounded claim that 6 million Jews were killed by Nazi Germany in systematic industrial-scale genocide. The documented evidence overwhelmingly evinces that the official policy of the Reich government was, from the very beginning, the removal of the Jews from public life and eventually from the entire German sphere of influence via either peaceful emigration or forced resettlement. The transfer agreement, the Evian Conference, the minutes of the Wannsee Conference all attest to this. A very significant document in this regard is the Luther Memorandum, an authentic and authoritative document of August 1942, and this is when the alleged industrial-scale genocide was supposed to be in full swing. The document stated, quote, "It is the unalterable decision of the Führer that after the war, the Jews will have to leave Europe." The physical evidence for the existence and operation of gas chambers is nil, as are the traces of huge amounts of human remains in numbers anywhere near approaching the 6 million figure. The entire foundation of the Holocaust story falls on the confessions and eyewitness testimonies. It is not denied that the Germans were tortured for confessions, as the book Legions of Death openly brags about it. The eyewitnesses have no credibility, and they were not even cross-examined at Nuremberg. There were hundreds of thousands of repentant eyewitnesses to witches' Sabbaths during the Middle Ages. Likewise, there are even more eyewitness accounts to personal contact with extraterrestrials. However, such personal accounts are absolutely worthless if there is no physical or documented evidence to corroborate them, as is the case with the Holocaust. But of course, many Jews died and suffered during the war, and during many camp liberations, hundreds, not millions, of dead skeletal Jews were found. But despite hundreds of autopsy reports done by the Allies, not one autopsy report proved anyone was killed by poison gas, but rather they had succumbed to typhus. Revisionists believe the Allies are equally responsible for the state the Jews were found in during the camp liberations, because in the last months of the war, Germany was being bombed into the Stone Age. No one denies that Jews suffered or died. We deny the 6 million is an irresponsible exaggeration and believe the true figure to be in the hundreds of thousands, dead from influences of war. There was no Hitler order and no gas chambers. There are scientific studies and documents to corroborate such a viewpoint. But instead of having these questions answered, we are slandered, called anti-Semitic, and censored. And yet, when their truth is spoken, it is met by the lowliest of comments, devoid of any content, only filled with hate, blindness, and a brainwashed kind of stubbornness. To call Holocaust revisionists conspiracy theorists is equally ridiculous. Conspiracy theorists are usually hysterical and rabid, while academics are usually calm and factual. Which side is hysterical and rabid here?
Germans are involved. For instance, if we tell there's something vulgar about lying about Germans, and thinking that it's proper. For instance, it was a lie that Germans cooked Jews to make soap from them. It was a lie, and it was institutionalized.
No, not a lie. Not a lie. It's a mistake.
That's not true. They made lampshades and they cooked soap. That's true.
Ask the professor. Ask the professor.
Historians make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. We're always refining our knowledge, and some of these things come down. down and they don't turn out to be true. But let me tell you what I think is
this going. This is not true. Tell her it's
let
not
me,
true.
Let me tell you what I think is going.
Because and ask why they're doing that to this woman. Why have they taught this woman to believe the Germans cooked and skipped?
Yes.
Did you see them yourself?
I was 7 months in Auschwitz.
And you
I
saw them make
lived
soap
near
for
the
people?
Crematorium as far as I am from you. I smelled you would never eat roast chicken if you would have been there. Because I smelled 24
you
hours roast chicken.
You mentioned soap and lampshades. Let's get to the bottom of one thing. She says soap and lampshades.
Yes.
The professor says you're mistaken.
You know
is there
even
room
the Germans
for open debate?
Admitted.
Is there,
they
is there
admitted
room?
That they had lampshades from...
Right. Do you have any empathy at all?
Why would anyone do this
to
her?
Are you concerned about the pain that you cause this woman?
Sure. Yeah, but why should we
accepting the virtue of your motives here.
Why should we ignore the Germans who are accused of this despicable story?
Listen, so in other words, you feel that...
I was 7 months there. If you are blind, somebody else is here.
No soap, no lampshades. Let her finish one story.
Yes.
Listen, the professor says you're wrong, that's all.
No, he wasn't there.
Oh.
They certainly...
And the Germans themselves said that. Yeah. And the people...
Yes, sir. You have
yes, one. The Holocaust is big business because Germany so far... has given the Jews, I think, at least $200 billion. So it's big business. And some of you are still getting $1,000 a month. And a lot of people don't know this. And then people don't realize who brought the slaves to America. They were Jewish ships.
Wait a minute.
The whole Holocaust debate is put to rest when one considers articles written over several decades before World War II even started. In various mainstream newspapers and black and white, that 6 million Jews were being persecuted, starved, killed, and rounded up in Eastern Europe and Russia. Now this is historical evidence that nobody can refute, all reporting the same 6 million number in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. Now that doesn't just prove the 6 million number is a hoax to this very day. It proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's a highly coordinated and sinister conspiracy behind mainstream media, government, finances, and world Zionism that funnels money back to the cabal that created it. The scientific analysis of the gas chamber is conclusive, irrefutable, and the smoking gun of the whole ordeal.
Ultimately, and with this I conclude, our objective should be to create a society where denial of the genocide is seen as so outrageous and so despicable that anyone who engages in it would be rendered a pariah. Thank you very much.
Power don't come from a badge or a gun. Power comes from lying. Lying big and getting the whole damn world to play along with you. Once you got everybody agreeing with what they know in their hearts ain't true, you got them by the balls. There's what, maybe 500 people in this hospital. I could pump you full of bullets right now and I wouldn't even be arrested. Everyone would lie for me, everyone who counts. Otherwise, all their own lies, everything that runs Sin City, it all comes tumbling down like a pack of cards.
Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Trouble so hard, ooh, Lord, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know.